This is the Moonifest Destiny Podcast, number 28. Moonifest Destiny is a novel I wrote back in 1991. The subtitle is The Rough and Ready Balloon Invasion of the Lunar Peninsula of Texas. My name is Peter Gelman. If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please go back and start with episode 1. Moonifest Destiny is available on Kindle for 99 cents. I will now read chapter 27, The Gollywog. As our cannon banged above us, and their bombs whanged all around the bombproof, down in the dugout of Company C, affectionately called Calhoun's own crawdad hole, Kelly was leading some of the men in prayer for the life of our commander. I didn't pray. I didn't think it would do any good. On the one hand, I had seen with my own innocent eyes more than 36 tiny puncture holes in the major's flesh, where the iron had driven in at dreadful velocity. On the other hand, I come to the unhappy conclusion that our creator was either negligently asleep at the lever in the locomotive of planets, or worse, an ornery cuss who didn't care a hoot about good triumphing over evil, seeing as he had hurt a good man and spared me, an evil man, practically a murderer. There was a worsest conclusion, that maybe there weren't nobody driving that locomotive of planets after all. That locomotive drove itself. That made me mad. I paced up and down the dugout, cursing in my head. And I didn't notice that pretty soon I was cursing out loud. Until Kelly looked up and said, "Shut up, Jack." I spat back, "You make me shut up, sir." Kelly's neck turned red, but he just pretended not to notice, either sparing me or sparing himself, because I was feeling like I did that time 12 years before when I clobbered him in the head with a log. He wouldn't get off my rope swing. As I paced, I grumbled about the automaton, who was just like a locomotive that run itself. I said someone ought to string him up. Some of the other crawdads who saw him duck the shell before it fell agreed that he didn't do enough to warn the major that the shell was going to blow. "That metal man seems to know a little too much," I grumbled. Lately, wherever Prince President Franklin Stowe went, he brought with him a thick swarm of blue-eyed flies. That, of course, didn't make any sense, because what does a fly want from a coal-fired clockwork automaton? He had a funny stink to him, but I only figured it was furnace fumes. "How come he calls himself a prince president is what I want to know," I complained, pacing. "It's like he thinks he's better nor us, just because he's made of metal." Well, I didn't realize that Sarah had come in from the ladies' dugout on her way to the infirmary dugout. Sarah called out, "Now, Jack, you just leave off the professor. He ain't like us exactly, but he's all right by me." I saw that full moon midnight twinkle in her Apache eyes, that twinkle set aside for me. I stared at her with a bad smile. I said, "So, you're sweet on him now, are you?" Sarah laughed. "Listen to Jack fire at his blank cartridge." And all the men started laughing. Sarah's eyes met mine for half a second, a half a second full of I-beams crossing and crashing, clashing and slashing like sabers. Her skirts flashed, and she was gone to hold the hand of a dying man. So I paced some more, but without so much gall and gumption now. It was like she had thrown a bucket of water into my furnace fire. I sought a measure of solitude, so I lit my southern vector, outpaced my northern. I noticed a movement in the dark there. Way back in the shadows, I saw someone crouching. It was Captain Miles Socrates. He crouched there, hiding among the boxes and barrels, spitting and worrying an old chicken bone, and rubbing it now again with a feather. "Old sock," I whispered, "you know you ain't allowed to hide here. You'll get us in big trouble." "Now, Boss Jack, don't throw me out. Don't do that. My master and missus are crazy, that's what they are. They're making me crazy. Don't throw me out, and I'll tell you why that professor's a prince president. I'll tell you all about him." The old man pressed my arm as he whispered. The touch filled me with such a complicity of fellow wickedness, I could not say no. "Well," I whispered, sitting so to hide him better, "all right, until I hear the captain calling for you, at least." "You won't hear nothin'," said Old Sock confidently. "My master is boss of the fort now. He don't got time to look for me. He got to stay upstairs, he do, and fight 'em moonermen. And missus, she's praying and crying for the major. My hoodoo bones done real good, spinning on them webs of forget-me. Come on, Old Sock, that old witchcraft is just superstition." "Says you, superstition is just another word for how did that work? Well, do you understand a telegrasp, a steam train, a big old balloon? How come hot air goes up when folks who got the fever go down? Well, I trust machines to work because they're inventions of science." "Jack, you got superstition that a telegrasp can talk 100 miles and more. You got superstition that a steam train can roll up a hill. And land sakes, it do that. And I got the same superstition that this old mighty old bone can spin webs of forget-me. And it do that. Only thing different is I call it hoodoo, and you call it seance." "Not seance, science." "Oh, well, science is just white folk talk for seance. Same thing. Then I got science right here in this seance bone. 'Cause when I ask it right, and say the right charms and all, it works forget-me's, and lady-be-trues, and no weapons, and go-away ghost, and other things like hook a fish, feel all better, and tell me. Now about that Franklin stove, Prince President, he got plenty seance in his head. You wanted to know about what Prince President means. Fine. Let me just ask the old bone to tell me. Then the old man proceeded to tap his feather on the bone, telegraph style, with his eyes closed and his brow furrowed. Then he nodded slowly, opened his eyes, licked his lips, and told me. "All right, the bone tell me that. Let me see now. The prince part of that prince president is the principle of the machine. The president part means the election of the principle, or, in other words, the freedom of it. Now I'm going to ask the old bone what that mean." Old Sock applied the feather to the bone, as before. Tell me, old bone," he mumbled. He opened his eyes. "The bones say that there metal man is nothing but a two-head." "What's a two-head?" "A two-head's a gollywog." "What's a gollywog?" "A two-head gollywog is a big old..." "Well, I'll tell you, Jack, there's an old tale among us folks that learns our babies the god-awful sin of reading and writing. Old tale now, he's so old and nearly forgotten, except for them old wise witches of the swamp shacks. Goes like this. It was in the Piedmont of Virginia that a slave preacher named of Alfred Bitt taught himself to read and write by studying the Bible as his mistress read it to all the plantation slaves. By the light of the moon, Alfred Bitt snuck out and counted all the letters of the Holy Testament and put numbers on the letters. He called it the magic spell wheel. As he spoke, Old Sock traced out A, B, C, etc. in a circle and numbered the letters 1, 2, 3, etc. alongside the outside of the circle so that it did indeed look mysterious, like an army cipher, and magical, like an incantation. Scratching in the dirt, the old man showed me how, with the help of the magic spell wheel, Alfred Bitt learned the code of a holy power. 7, plus 15 plus 4, and figured the sum of the magic word, 26. With that sum, he figured out the proportions and stuffing of a perfect form, which he then built in a broken old barn. He made the giant thing of clay in the shape of a man. It was a mighty fine and fearsome statue, but that's all it was. But bad old Alfred Bit, he wasn't happy with the natural way it was. So on one foot he wrote W. He did that because he figured 19 minus 9 minus 4 equals minus 4, which was the number of sin, S-I-N. And then he went backward on the wheel to get W, which, by the way, is M, for man turned upside down, falling into hell. For the other foot, he figured the number of pride, P-R-I-D-E, 16 plus 18 plus 9 plus 4 plus 5, and got 52. So he went around the wheel exactly twice and got Z, and wrote that Z, which, old Sock explained, looked like a sneaky 2, which is B, which stands for Beelzebub. Trembling with fear, Alfred Bit dared to use the forbidden power of the magic words and numbers. He wrote that most terrible and powerful word of all on the forehead of the clay man. What do you think that word was? That word was not man, M-A-N. No, sir. That word was G-O-D. Wow, the giant shook all over, like with fever, and a look of pain most terrible and awful passed over his features. That pain twisted on his nose like a crank, twisting him to ugliness, terrible, my gosh, and nightmare-like, and mean as the devil. It was the Gollywog, Jack. That Gollywog sneaks and lives in all us folks' nightmares. The Gollywog, terrible as it was, now alive as you or me, knew it just shouldn't be alive. It knew it. It knew it was the sin of pride. It knew it was the product of an evil rebellion against the Creator's plan. So it got meaner. It scowled and frowned. It got all dark in the face. And it accused its master, Alfred Bit, of cruelty, yes, and crime against nature. Alfred Bit just laughed and laughed. Then the Gollywog fell on its big stone knees and begged for death, since it suffered every second of its wrongful existence, not having the divine liberty of a soul inside. For it is only the soul inside that can find freedom, but not that old wizard. Alfred, he had neither shame nor mercy. Nope, no sir. He thought he was just as good as the white folks. Yes, he did. So then Alfred bid the Gollywog, "Rise up, boy. You better do exactly what I say. I want you to rise up in bloody rebellion. Get up and bust the heads of all the slave masters, 'cause now that I know my magic spell wheel, I'm your master, bad old Gollywog." The Gollywog rose up most high and terrible. With a cruel grin, it said, "Oh yes, I obey you, my master." And it put out its terrible hands, big as barrels, smack around Alfred Bit's poor neck. Well, crushed against the barn wall, Alfred Bit was choking and a-coughing for his very life. He was so scared of dying a sinner that he grabbed around the wall for something to fight back with. He found a pitchfork and used it, but the fork bent against the stone hide of the Gollywog, and the handle just broke to splinters. He found an axe and chopped with it, but the axe broke apart too. He might as well have hit a freight train. The only thing left in the wall to grab was something very small, flat, and round, hanging on a nail. Alfred Bit was dying, so he grabbed that too. When he saw it was just a looking glass, he just about gave up the ghost. But then, with his last breath, he got an idea. He choked out,
Wait, Master Gollywog, don't you want to look at your handsome divine face in the reflection of this looking glass?
The Gollywog, it got curious. It let go of Alfred Bitt like he was nothing at all. It snatched the glass and stared into it. There it spied on its unnatural face with all its strength and power. And the Gollywog filled with pride. It thought itself a mighty fine and handsome-looking Gollywog. A beau of a Gollywog for all the lady Gollywogs around. Worse than that, it thought itself a new god, master of everything. And right then, before it could tear its mean old eyes away, it saw that word on its forehead. But it saw it reflected. It read it out, but backwards. It made out the word to be D-O-G, which spells dog, the old man whispered, scratching in the dirt. And Alfred Bitt yelled out laughing, "You dumb old Gollywog, you ain't nothing but a dog, and I am a-gonna kick you to hell." Alfred kicked and kicked at the Gollywog. Right then and there, that most big and ugly-looking Gollywog fell all apart into a heap and dust and dirt and just a mangy old kick dog down there and all that dirty dust of nothing. And I tell you, Jack, that dog ran a howling for mercy. Well, if you want to hear the rest, Alfred Bitt, he felt so sorry and ashamed. He run and woke up and confessed to his master. His master heard it all, yes, and understood it all, yes, and forgave it all. With a fatherly hand on Alfred Bitt's old head, the master bid him and his babies never read nor write again, for it only brings us slaves to ruin and unhappiness and unnatural pride beyond our britches. So, Boss Jack, I think that there Prince President's a kind of Gollywog, too, only he's tin. "You wait a minute, old sock," I whispered. "I see the trick in the story, you old liar. I got to admit, you got gumption, old man. It's just a sneaky way to teach slaves how to read and write, and how to count. Ain't it?" Old sock looked at me, his face a block of wood. Suddenly he crouched and cupped his ear to the hoodoo bone. "What's that, old bone? Tell me, tell me."
"Hey," Sergeant Mallory called. "Get the heck out of here, you old black devil."
"Oh, oh, oh," the old man exclaimed, too foolishly.
"Yes, sir."
He sprang away, twisting his bare feet over the magic spell wheel, and ran off before any crawdads could catch him.
Thank you for listening. Well, I included a slave character in this story because I think there would be a problem with not including it in a novel that tries to examine themes of Manifest Destiny. At the time of Manifest Destiny, slavery was legal. The United States was having a hard time dealing with its contradictions. The details of that institution are not just offensive and disgusting, but painful. Painful to consider. I didn't like reading with even a suggestion of slave vernacular, but I think it would be wrong to misrepresent the poverty and pain of past social crimes. There was the theory of slavery as a natural and noble institution, like Athens, by its proponents at the time. And then there was a decrepit reality. And that's why this character's formal name is Socrates, but everyone calls him by his tawdry name, Old Sock. And since, if I recall right, it was only after the early 19th century slave rebellions that states made it illegal to teach slaves to read. It was obviously a form of social control and oppression. The Crocodile Tears explanation of the time was that it was in the slave people's own interest to keep them uneducated so that they would remain in their natural station of society. The laws against teaching slaves to read so self-serving reminds me of the Upton Sinclair quote, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." Nonetheless, some slaves taught themselves how to read, and I find the subterfuge among the slaves intriguing. Another form of the trickster story. You probably caught the inspiration for the Gollywog creature of clay, the golem story from Jewish legend. At the time, I thought the Gollywog was a doll with possible sinister resonance in the slave culture. But I looked on the web just now, and they claim it came out later in the late 19th century. One book I remember reading around the time, I think right before I wrote this novel, Frederick Douglass, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave. It's remarkably readable prose. I read a lot of American works, 19th century works, and his is one of the most readable and palatable to modern tastes. There were many striking details in his story. To me, one was in his life, a family in Baltimore took possession of him, and the woman of the household started out very sweet to him, but over time, the power relationship of the institution transformed her, a horrible and cruel person. Another thing I remember from reading that book was how his owner hired him out to work in the shipyards, and he would fight with the Irish workers there. There seems to be a social principle where people near the bottom hate and detest the people at the bottom. Maybe everyone has a natural hostility to people one step below them because of the threat. Here's what Frederick Douglass wrote about his escape from slavery and arrival in New York. I have often been asked how I felt when first I found myself on free soil, and my readers may share the same curiosity. There was scarcely anything in my experience about which I could not give a more satisfactory answer. A new world had opened upon me. If life is more than breath and a quick round of blood, I lived more in one day than in 1 year of my slave life. It was a time of joyous excitement, which words can but tamely describe. In a letter written to a friend soon after reaching New York, I said, I felt as one might feel upon escape from a den of hungry lions. Anguish and grief, like darkness and rain, may be depicted, but gladness and joy, like the rainbow, defy the skill of pen or pencil. I spent some of my youth growing up in Virginia, and we visited Mount Vernon, Washington's home. And I don't remember too much about it. I was pretty young then, but I remember one story they told about the slave child would be carrying a tray of food from the kitchen into the main house and would be required to whistle so that he would not be able to eat the food as he brought the tray. The tour guide, a little old lady, told us the story as an amusing anecdote. and it did amuse us. But later, I thought about it some more. And as you can see, now some maybe 40 years later, it's all I remember about that visit.
Moonfest Destiny is available on Kindle for 99 cents. Thank you.